Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC doesn't just measure alumni engagement scores. It uses academic research in cognitive science and positive psychology to actually increase an alum's willingness to give. Quantitative data, such as capacity, gets a prospect into your pipeline, but qualitative data, such as impact stories, gets a prospect through your pipeline. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights and automatically delivers them to major gift officers for use in cultivation. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive's training. If you're looking to align your entire team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about Responsive's four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, let's ensure that everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you prefer a virtual event, that'll work too. Let's get your team thinking critically and more carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I will also put some information in the show notes. Hi, Stephen. I am delighted to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast today. You and I have gotten to know each other a little bit through social media and through, I think we had a phone conversation sometime in sort of the pre-COVID world.
Yeah.
I think all of us sort of have this, our worlds sort of work this way. COVID and pre-COVID.
Right, exactly.
And anything that was pre-COVID just sort of exists in like a decade-long. Our family went out for dinner last night, Steve, and we were sitting there talking about something that was pre-COVID, and we can't even remember when it was. Our kids could have been like toddlers, and we wouldn't know the difference. Stephen, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast today. Before we get started with our conversation, how about you just introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. Thanks, Jason. I really appreciate you having me on. And my name's Stephen Gerber, and I'm with Executive Director of Development with Grace College and Seminary in Winona Lake, Indiana, and oversee our major gift officer program.
Stephen, I don't think I've had a seminary guy or gal on the podcast. I don't know that I've had a seminary. I think I recently had one, I guess, who probably just airs a couple of weeks ahead of you. But I haven't really talked to seminary folks on the podcast. How would you say that fundraising is different? Obviously, there's the sort of the faith component and those sorts of things. But what does it mean to raise money for a seminary?
Well, that's a really good question, Jason. I think that there are a lot of people that are raising money for seminaries, Christian colleges, faith-based organizations. It wouldn't exactly have my background, but it really helps. I'm a graduate of Grace Theological Seminary, and I pastored. I was in pastoral ministry for about 16 years, and over time involved in some other ministries, kind of where I cut my teeth in fundraising about 18, 19 years ago. So it's been a while, but I think having the seminary background's helpful, obviously not required.
Yes.
But and I tend to focus on fundraising efforts for the seminary because I love Grace Theological Seminary. I'm a graduate of it.
Sure.
But I also do a lot of fundraising for the college, you know, as well. And so I think that there's a lot of people with backgrounds that would be very different from mine that also do a really effective job, you know, in fundraising for seminaries. I have friends at Asbury, other schools as well. Yeah. So, yeah.
I've always been on the fence, and I probably picked this up. I think you and I share a similar path into the fundraising world because we both started in the faith-based organizations. But I've always been somewhat on the fence about whether or not I like pastoral leaders going into fundraising roles. What's your thoughts on that? I mean, some pastoral guys seem to sort of land in these fundraising roles because they're really just nice and friendly and those sorts of things. And then some pastoral types, I've seen them, and they're just complete rock stars. They sort of get it. They know how to sort of push beyond the sort of the glad handing and the friendly fellow sort of approach. Some of them sort of come with these hangups about money that maybe is instilled by the church, and some of them don't so much. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that there is sometimes, like you said, some hangups,
yeah.
You know, some things that people bring into it. I think as in all things in fundraising, I think you do have to have a really good philosophical basis, really, yeah. for what you're doing. It has to go beyond just, you know, shaking hands and rubbing elbows. I guess we should say in COVID, fist pumping, right? It has to go has to go beyond all of that. And there needs to be not only, I think, an understanding of your own philosophy of fundraising, but also how do you approach donors and how do you approach your benefactors. And I think that part of what has helped me so much, kind of not only during pastoral ministry, but then now in my efforts for Grace, is I did two things. One, I pursued the CFRE, and that was a big, huge help.
Yeah,
certainly. But I think with Lake Institute, with the IU School of Philanthropy, Lake Institute is kind of the religious, faith-based fundraising program, and I went through their executive certificate in religious fundraising, and that kind of helped solidify some things for me, because I had written a white paper all about kind of your Christian, your faith-based fundraising, and I think it's important to have that. I think you need that kind of that underpinning so that you can, you know, effectively do what you do, and I think get beyond just the surfacey kind of. I guess you would say, you know, you want to be more than a half inch deep and a 100 right. miles wide, right?
Right.
You want to have some understanding of the things that we all know and that your listeners know, a professional approach. But I think it needs to go well beyond that. And so that there's not that cheesiness and that kind of insincerity. You want to be genuine in what you do.
Definitely. Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. Stephen, we always ask our guests to come to the podcast with a big idea, bold opinion about our common profession. What do you got for us today? I think we got you warmed up. We put a little bit on the table. I think this is going to probably just sort of go right from there. So what do you got for us?
Yeah, no, I think faith and fundraising is something was kind of my big idea, is how do you look at fundraising really as a ministry? You know, I don't know that for your listeners that are faith-based, or maybe Christian college, a college that has a faith-based background, maybe a not-for-profit, you know, that has some kind of faith-based background. I do think that fundraisers in those areas sometimes struggle with, okay, I do these ministry things, I do these social service things, I care for these people, do this for my community. But they never really think of fundraising in and of itself as a ministry.
Yeah.
And, you know, Henry Nouwen, and a lot of people know Nouwen in his book, Spirituality of Fundraising. You know, he made a great observation. He said, fundraising is first and foremost a form of ministry.
Yeah.
And I think that when I talked about philosophy, that's what helps a lot of people, because they see, well, I do certain aspects or certain parts of my job, and the fundraising is, you know, I don't really follow my faith. maybe sometimes it's like, well, I learned this at that conference, or I picked up this here and that there, but they've never really thought about, you know, the ministry aspect of what they do. And I think that's important. And I think it was, you know, Nouwen, who also talked about really redeeming fundraising, like that it is, you know, we need to redeem the word fundraising. It's not a bad word. It's a great word if we understand, what it really means and what it's all about.
Yeah, I think the
thing, that's kind of my big idea.
Yeah, I think the thing that I oftentimes repeat with Nouwen's book, it's certainly something that anybody who's oftentimes given a platform, given an audience like I'm privileged to have pretty routinely. When I reference Nouwen's book, I'm oftentimes referencing that place in his little book. And for my listeners, we'll put a link in the show notes. It's Nouwen's Spirituality of Fundraising Isn't Hard to Find. I think there's even PDF copies out there on the internet somewhere. It's that idea that Nouwen talks about how we sort of indirectly sort of discriminate against the rich because which is sort of a complex concept to sort of talk about in sort of today's context, if you will. But it's that idea that we sort of assume that the person with all this wealth sort of has everything else that they need. And so we don't form meaningful relationships with them for the very reason that we assume that, well, because this fella or this gal has lots of money in the checking account, they don't need any of that other stuff. You know, if they need a meaningful person, if they need a person to have a meaningful conversation with, that they can do that with someone else. And what I think Nouwen's doing is he's sort of making that classic argument that we all talk about, whether we're in a faith-based context or not, that if all you're doing is sort of exploiting your donors just simply like ATMs, like how much money can I get out of this thing? There's no honor, there's no respect. And quite frankly, I don't find that we on the receiving side, on the fundraiser side, derive much meaningfulness from it. I think in some ways that's the reason why we end up with a lot of the turnover, is because we're not insisting on the fundraising side, insisting on doing more meaningful work. And I think right. Nouwen's book is perhaps one of those first books that I would hand to someone who I knew was trying to sort of derive more meaning in their work. Does that make sense?
No, it makes perfect sense. I think oftentimes we don't realize it, but because of the type of work we do, you know, whether that's, you know, helping people in need, the poor, the oppressed, whatever that is, even if it's a college, right, where you're trying to provide scholarships for students or whatever it may be. Sure. Sometimes I think we may have a prejudice, against the rich because or even as we might say, high net worth, individuals.
Yeah.
And we don't really see that because someone has wealth, there's still people who get lonely. You know, they struggle with a sense of being, they struggle with, my own personal worth. And we can really have a platform to within a faith-based or maybe an organization that has a religious background, we can minister to those individuals because just like us, they need acceptance, they need love, they need care, and deepening. You know, we often talk about deepening relationships, but then what does that actually look like? You know, how do we, through the work of fundraising, and really what I often try to separate for our gift officers is fundraising versus development. You know, where development is really that aspect of getting to know them, but earning the right to be heard and getting to the place where they welcome you, into their world. And, you know, the fundraising is when we actually, it's a very natural thing, right? At that point, we've earned the right to be heard and they want to give. But you're right. I think sometimes when it comes to the wealthy, we need to realize that part of what we can do for them is say, hey, we would like to invite you. We would like to have you come into what we're doing, to join us in what we're doing, because your heartbeat and our heartbeat are very similar. And rather than, I think you're right, rather than having this kind of, because I've seen it so much where, well, it's about the money, right? It's about the money.
Yeah.
And I think if you deepen and you expand and you drive a little bit further with individuals, especially those of high net worth, you will find that the it sounds trite, Jason, but it's not the money will follow that when there's sincerity, when there's genuineness, when there is a care on your part for them as an individual, their family. I think a lot of fundraisers know that. That's, you might even say that's fundraising 101, But I have seen where people often, you know, it becomes about, you know, get this gift from this person, get that gift from this person. And I've had donors tell me in my work over the years that, hey, Steve, you're the first gift officer, you're the first fundraiser with that organization that's ever contacted me the second time.
Yeah.
I've never had that happen before. Or especially when it goes into that third or that fourth, and now it's just a natural relationship. And so I do think, and it's probably not something we're conscious of, that there's a, could perhaps be somewhat of a prejudice in our minds, you know, against, you know, the rich or against those who are wealthy.
I think in some ways we sort of shoot ourselves in the foot with this idea. And we all get taught this. We get taught this in those fundraising 101 sort of courses. We get taught that fundraising is all about relationships. I don't think we ever really come to grips in those first couple of years of what that means. Then, and perhaps some of us are fortunate enough to actually get in front of a donor and to sort of what you're describing there with that individual who says, I'm somewhat surprised you picked up the phone the second time and sort of called me back, say subsequent to the first gift. I think more often than not, I think what I see happening oftentimes, especially with these individuals who have the capacity to give in very significant ways, it's sort of the emotional toll that our approach, which is a necessary and honorable approach, but if it's not authentic, that's what I'm getting at. The spirituality of fundraising that we're sort of talking about today, if it's not authentic, if it's not rooted in something, and I think my experience and yours has sort of proven that in many cases it's oftentimes rooted in some sort of spirituality, some sort of a religious tradition or something. But it, quite honestly, if it's not authentic in some sort of human way, it just becomes exhausting, because the donor on the other side of us. So we're out there sort of peddling this thing like we're a little robot. So we're behaving like a machine, right? Well,
sure.
If you think about being the donor on the other side of that, if you've got like, you know, say a dozen little robots, fundraising robots, like you or me, always calling on individuals for $10,000 or $15,000 or $25,000 checks, that's got to be somewhat exhausting for Mrs. Smith. I mean, you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, I think part of it is really getting to the root. And there's a whole nother discussion that goes along with this. When you think about spirituality of fundraising, there's this whole other idea of stewardship and what does that mean, and money and possessions. How do we look at that? How do we view that? How do we use our money? How do we use our possessions? I think of a former ministry I was at where maybe, like you said, kind of cutting your teeth a little bit during some of those early years, maybe as long about my third or fourth year. And I remember visiting with a donor and thinking to myself and even having this discussion with them about, you know, how often are you approached about giving to causes? Because this was a high net worth, you know, individual. And how often does this happen? And, you know, at that time, you know, it's funny looking back, right? We all know this, but, you know, the donor goes over, she grabs a stack of letters, probably 40 of them, and says, that was last week, you know. And that was last week. It's about an inch, you know, for your listeners, it's about an inch thick. You know, she's going, that was last week.
Right.
And so it's just always kind of reminded me that, you know, the sincerity that's needed and kind of moving away from, as we understand not only our view of possessions and money, but helping the donors with that concept, that we kind of move away from, you know, I'm here to make the ask. I'm here to do a big ask. That rather we kind of look at the, like I said earlier, the invitation to participate, the, would you join us in this? And that invitation is more based on their desire, right? I mean, they're not only their heart in it, but they don't tire of it because you've kind of earned that right over time that, you know, you may not be number one,
right?
But you might be number three, you might be number four. And so there's this growing relationship that, and you said that earlier, and that's a very interesting topic too. The relationship primarily, I think in this case, their relationship, however their faith is defined that for them, but also for the organization. I think we often forget that my role is to really deepen that relationship for the organization that I represent.
Yeah.
You know, it's about that. And it's about that mission and that vision of that organization that we want to, you know, that we want to see that we're inviting them really into that. And I like how the Lake Institute says it, Jason, going from this concept of holding back or basically a scarcity mindset versus a generosity and abundance mindset.
Yeah.
You know, I describe it to people visually as helping go from a closed hand, you know, to an open hand. And while these are some pretty philosophical ideas, they really play themselves out practically when we're working with our donors, when we're making asks, when we're sending those letters. I mean, you're creating that environment. We say culture a lot, creating that culture of generosity and abundance rather than, you know, withholding and scarcity. Yeah. And that's those are really different mindsets and different mentalities. Well,
you'll appreciate this. I mean, it's not just philosophical. It's also it's also the way ecosystems work. You know, you're in Indiana and I'm in central Pennsylvania. I've got a cornfield in my backyard that, you know, it's just one species essentially of corn, and it's not very diverse. And it's, you know, it's an ecosystem that essentially just represents sort of one species of corn. It's not very robust, and it would only take one pest to sort of come in here and sort of wipe it out. And when you incorporate sort of that diversity of sort of thought and experience and depth and meaning and all of those sorts of things that come with much more meaningful work, when you incorporate some of the things that we like to understand when it comes to sort of faith, what you and I would have talked about in all of our training and all those sorts of things, sort of the substance that sort of comes with these gifts, it becomes a much more sort of robust fundraising process. I'm reminded of a client I was working with, Stephen, in Texas, and a number of years ago, and it was a private school, and they were deliberately a secular school, and they were constantly saying, I was working on a feasibility study, I probably interviewed 40 families, and every other meeting, they very much insisted, because the brand was wrapped around this notion of being a secular school, and these people wanted to raise $8 or $10 million for their first building campaign or something, and every other meeting incorporated this notion of sort of being secular. They were not generous in the sort of any sort of traditional sort of religious sense. They did, these folks almost, I think I had one gentleman sort of tell me, I don't have a value of generosity. And I remember writing in the report, and when I presented the report, I said, look, folks, I said, I don't think there's anything wrong with you being a secular school. I don't think you have to bring Jesus to work, you know, into the classroom every day. You guys do what you want to do, right? But I said, your people don't have a value of generosity. Your people have either directly or indirectly sort of told me this. And most of us learn that generosity from some sort of ecosystem, getting back to the sort of the corn analogy, that actually comes from the environment with which we're sort of reared in. And when it's not a generous environment, which means it's not sort of giving and taking, giving and receiving, when it's sort of not providing nutrients to other plants and stuff, and then when it's just sort of sapping all the energy out of it, it doesn't thrive. It doesn't thrive. Right. And I think, and there were people in the room that sort of spoke up, and they were like, yeah, you know, we really hinge our identities on this sort of this being a secular institution, but in some ways we're going to have to find this value of generosity somewhere. Right.
Yeah. I think that's an interesting study all in of itself, is this kind of this idea that some people, and I know the University of Notre Dame did some studies on this a few years
generosity
back.
Generosity research,
that's right. And the Lake Institute references that often. And people, I don't think we realize, whether secular or faith-based, religious-based, there is a mindset and part of a person's upbringing and background and the way they look at giving. There are people that, you know, are high net worth individuals, or at least they make a very good income, they really, surprisingly maybe to some of us in our work, but they're really not people who are generous. Yeah, it's not. Right. And some people, when they were interviewed in this study, didn't know really why. Like, as they thought about it, well, we probably should be giving. We probably, because they weren't faith-based, and they didn't go to church on a regular basis. They weren't really involved in their community in terms of maybe a local not-for-profit or social service organization or whatever it might be. And so they never really developed from childhood on. They saw models of, hey, this is the money I made and it's mine. And so they kind of, it's not that they necessarily have a hoarding attitude. It's kind of this scarcity attitude, like this is mine and I'm going to hold on to it. And that could impact all of us. I mean, that could come into play. But I think that part of, at least in the spheres in which we work, part of our understanding needs to be that not everyone comes to the table with the same background and identity when it comes to this idea of generosity. We can't assume anything in terms of that. Well, don't you give to something? Don't you give to the causes in your community? Actually, there are many, many people who do not. And I think understanding that and then sort of flipping that on its head, right, with the work that we do, where we have the opportunity to do something very, very different. Instead of, and part of that scarcity mentality too, and this is a little bit of a different illustration of this, but as a fundraiser, sometimes you can get in that mindset too. It's a kind of a strange kind of thing, but years ago, I was brand new at an organization, and I remember our vice president actually getting up at an event and putting some coins in a tin cup.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a joke. We call it the Tin Cup Award, and we would give it to. It could be, it was a joke, but it kind of created this idea of, now am I begging because I'm a fundraiser, or am I actually doing more than begging? Well, it's really the opposite of begging. And I think when we approach people, if we have a worthy mission, if we have a vision that is amazing and exciting, and it is something that we stand for passionately, that we can invite people into that, whether they have that scarcity mentality or an abundance mentality. It's the same. And maybe for the person that has that scarcity mentality, it might just take longer. I mean, it might take longer to develop that rather than assuming that they have a generous mindset. We might be in some way able to help them. And it might not even be us. And that's where fundraisers get uncomfortable, but I'm not uncomfortable in that space.
So I'm looking right over my head, is a bunch of books. And I read the two, because I'm working on a book project right now. And I looked at those generosity studies that were done at Notre Dame a couple of years ago. So I think that some of that stuff's probably 10 years old now at this point. It's really good stuff. But I'm interested to hear your thoughts on this. One of the things that they basically came to the conclusion on is that about half of us, and for the sake of our listeners, we'll put some links to these texts, these books, in some of the research. Some of it you don't have to actually buy the books; you can get the actual reports online. But basically what Notre Dame and the folks doing this research sort of came to the conclusion was that about 50%, this is all, for the sake of my listeners, this is all the stuff that Stephen's been referencing for the last few minutes. About half of our population just doesn't describe themselves, doesn't lean into, and doesn't sort of live into the identity of being generous. So if we sort of take the religiosity, take the faith sort of component out of it, we don't have to have the tension of sort of secular versus, what do you believe in sort of part of the spirituality, sort of part of the conversation going. But if you just sort of settle on and you look at that research, they basically came to the realization that about 50% of our population just doesn't want to, will not be, just think real practically, they're just not generous people. And I think that in some ways, and this is kind of where I was hoping to go today, I remember you and I sort of setting up this conversation. I think that sort of rattles us in the fundraising space, especially those who are really into sort of the new acquisition and sort of the churn and burn sort of stuff. Because what it in some ways does is it sort of draws a line in the sand, and it doesn't allow us to sort of recognize that everyone, anyone and everyone is sort of our potential donor. Because what it does is it sort of distinguishes between the generous and the not generous. I mean, that's really what this study came down to. And I think fundraising for so long, I'm going to come off of this soapbox here in a minute. I think for so long, fundraising has hinged on the donor as a consumer. And we're all in this society today, we're all defined by that of being a consumer, which pretty much makes anybody and everybody your prospective donor. But when you take that consumer identity away and you say, you know what, giving is not consumer behavior, but it's something else. And if perhaps it's generosity, and it's part of being a part of a community, expressing some sort of value that's sort of rooted in a tradition or a faith or something like that. What that really comes down to, Stephen, is it cuts 50% of our 50% of the people that we think we want to talk to, we really don't want to talk to, and perhaps makes our job a little bit easier. And the guy who's trying to sell your school on a new acquisition program, who wants to mail to hundreds, if not hundreds of thousands of donors, all of a sudden doesn't have quite as robust a sales pitch anymore, does he? Because half those people that, yeah, they might be buying stuff at, Walmart and Target, but they're not as likely, they're just not as inclined to give to your school. And it really has nothing to do, nothing really more to say about them other than they're just not generous people.
Yeah, I think we just have to recognize that as a fact.
Yeah, just
right?
Be okay with it.
It's okay. Yeah. It's all right. And we understand that not everyone is going to want to or will get involved in giving to our organization.
Yeah.
We may have a conversation like that with what we think is a prospective donor, and maybe at some point that person's mindset, their attitude, their heart motivations, they'll change. Yeah. And maybe in some way our conversation with them might facilitate that. They may end up at some point giving to some other organization, some other ministry, some other cause. Yeah. And that's okay too. I think we just have to be comfortable in that space. And this kind of goes back to those donor kind of basics, right? Of knowing who your constituency is, knowing what motivates that constituency. I think for we talk about, the expression money follows mission. Yeah. And there's definitely truth to that. But I also think for some people, there's something about what you do, how you do it, what your organization stands for, that they just like people in our case, for example, with a college, and your listeners who are at colleges or universities know this, that hey, they like athletics. I mean, they just like it. So they're really involved. They want to give, or, they're really into science, or they're really into education, or, they're really into the medical field. And so those are kind of the motivating factors, I think, beyond mission. But I think it's okay to recognize that. I think here's the hard part, and we really have a hard time swallowing this, Jason. You know what? Not all of our alumni are going to be interested in giving.
Yeah.
They're just not.
Is it harder? You know? Going back to my question when we first started. So think about your peers, your colleagues in the fundraising space that are pastoral leaders first. We're pastoral leaders. If you think about that particular space, there's that desire to sort of convert everyone, right? But I'm thinking about the books that you and I have apparently read the same books. There's an entire chapter in one of those books about that. We're going back to the Notre Dame study here. There's an entire chapter in there that basically sort of says there is a non-generous part of our population. It's almost like they're suggesting it's in their DNA, and you don't have to necessarily convert them to being generous. And I think in some ways, if you think about it in the context of our faith-based organizations, we have to be okay with that. There's people in our databases, there's people that we're calling on that just don't have the inclination to sort of respond. And as quickly as we can figure out who those people are, it means we can sort of let them off the hook and then double down and interact with the people who truly do want to be generous. Am I right?
I think, yes, and I think that is really where, you know, we talk about, you know, looking, taking a deep dive into your database, looking at, you know, the particulars, the different characteristics. And, but that's really, I guess I'm a practitioner. I've always been a practitioner in this. And so as a practitioner, I really find that's where the, what I call the hard work of development really does is it digs down into exactly what you're talking about and says, let's spend, you know, like I challenged our gift officers this year, let's spend, you know, 80% of our time dealing with this group because look at what they've done over the last 10 to 15 years. Let's spend 10% on this group and 10% on that group because we only have so much time to put toward the cause. And so I think sometimes, you know, we can allow ourselves, I mean, we can allow other parts of what we do, whether that's a mailing program, you know, and IU talks a lot of school of philanthropy talks a lot about the four legs of the school. You know, maybe your annual fund is the right place. And as gift officers, as major gift fundraisers, we're not spending all of our time with this. and I don't, this idea over your head of, oh man, I've got to get this group of people to give. Well, you know what? You probably don't.
Need to move on.
And, you know, well, I know them. I have a relationship. Well, what's that relationship based on? If it's not based on a growing interest in your organization's mission and vision and that money is not following mission in that particular donor case, then yeah, you have to put them in the right place, but then you move on and you move on to areas where you can be more effective and work with people where you can be more effective. And I think from the faith-based, from the religious standpoint, you know, when you start working with the right people, you start to sense that I'm in the right space. I'm with the right people. I'm doing the right things. You're always trying to reacquisition in. You're always trying to develop new donors and in your pipeline. You have to be doing that, but you really focus on that group that's already giving, right? And you develop that so that those gifts could perhaps grow, you know, over time. And I think part of a lot of what we do is some acceptance that, hey, I'm not going to reach everybody. And some of the best fundraisers I've ever known have not closed on every gift they ask, right? And we experience that every year where we have proposals and we don't close on all of them. But, you know, we try to get the percentages in our favor as much as we can.
Stephen, I certainly hope that our listeners aren't thinking that we're trying to evangelize and being proselytizing and all that stuff today. But is it accurate to say that, in your mind, you know, I remember in this, probably I was raised in the United Methodist Church, for example. And so we heard a lot of John Wesley growing up, and I'm sure I'm going to botch up this expression, but John Wesley was that guy who sort of talked about how, if capitalism was doing what it was supposed to do, you know, God sort of, you know, it allowed sort of us to sort of shovel it in so that we could shovel it out. There's some sort of expression there, but it's the idea that we want people to sort of to thrive in whatever their lifelong endeavors are so that they, you know, and they shovel it in and accumulate it and all that sort of stuff. And then they're able to shovel it back out into causes like any of our listeners represent. But what I'm getting at is that even if we're not a faith-based organization, it seems to me that sort of perhaps digging into a very simple document like Now in Spirituality of Fundraising, and I can certainly recommend a couple others, I'm sure you can too, can sort of help us reconcile some of the quandaries that we tend to get into in fundraising. I think that if you can appreciate what is faith and what is tradition and what is religion, and you can sort of allow that to sort of at least be aware of what that is, even if you're not the faith-based organization on the corner in town, can't it help us reconcile some of the sort of the knots that we get ourselves tied up in? Are you following my thinking, Stephen?
No, absolutely. I think that the principles transcend just faith-based or religious.
I think that
it could help even in a, because I also did some fundraising for a time in a secular organization in my background, and you know, it was just these principles of you know, of looking, taking a deeper dive into what development, what relationships actually mean, how to approach people. It actually served me well when I worked for a secular organization raising funds for them. And I think that, because I think sometimes we think, well, you guys have an advantage because you're faith-based, or if the opposite may be true a lot of times, like, well, you know, you don't have the religious baggage. Some people might even think that way that we have. And I think the point is, right, it's really be who you are. Yeah. You have a mission that can really, that will, not just can or should, but will resonate with a lot of people. And I can't think of, honestly, when I wake up every day, I cannot think of a greater work that could be done than fundraising. I mean, we have people out here raising funds for causes that are just outstanding, right? And they are so worthy. And I think that we need to get to the place where we kind of look at it, you know, from that standpoint. And one of the books, too, that's a really good resource, Carrie Robinson, Imagining Abundance. I would encourage everybody to get a copy of that one. She really gets into this, I think probably does one of the best jobs I've seen of looking at fundraising and philanthropy and the spiritual side. But then also there's so many things that Carrie Robinson talks about that translate very well to the secular side. Like, you know, the idea that she was raising money for a capital campaign. And there were people at this, you know, that got involved in giving to this Catholic university because they just simply saw that, hey, within our community, there should be a need to have a chapel, maybe where people could go to, maybe just to have times of quiet, times of silence. And so a lot of Carrie Robinson's principles in Imagining Abundance can really help a lot of people in that thought process, too.
Yeah, you remind me of some of the reading I've been doing lately on this notion of what they call cathedral building and cathedral projects. And I think that's where, because I've been thinking a lot about how do we sort of remedy the way that a lot of these capital campaigns sort of are playing out now, where people are saying they are becoming, even though we're talking about extraordinary levels of raising money, they're still very transactional and still feeling very mechanical and somewhat shallow. And this notion of cathedral building and the idea that to build a cathedral, anybody who's sort of been in the business of building cathedrals or anything of the like knows that these projects sort of extend beyond that. It's an opportunity to get your ego out of the way because cathedral building, cathedral projects are those opportunities where the project is going to extend beyond sort of the lifetime or the tenure of any one individual or group. And I think it's the achievement of capital campaigns and the idea that our board or our chair or our executive director or our president is going to accomplish this that perhaps gets in the way. It becomes very mechanical. It becomes very much about the money. Because I think there's sort of a redeeming, you know, we're using very religious terms here, but I think there's a redemption that some people want in a lot of this stuff that we've been doing for decades that we've actually got really good at. At a time like this where social distance is very necessary and we don't know when it's going to sort of go away. We might be communicating with donors like you and I are communicating for quite some time now. We don't really know. It's very unpredictable. If there's not more substance to it, whatever that substance is, it's just not going to work.
Yeah. I think in some ways, as we talk about our field and the field of fundraising, where's it going?
Yeah.
You know, what's the next level?
Yeah.
And I think in the context of maybe I'll say faith-based fundraising, I think part of what I'm seeing is there's been a huge sweeping change in, for example, in church-based fundraising where, you know, it was always this idea of pass the plate.
Yeah.
And that's really many churches are moving away from that, where it's more about individual connection. You know, we talk about what does it mean? Well, one meaning could be more individual connection. I was with a ministry years ago that 80% of their support came from churches. And during my time there, during my 8-year tenure, that flipped on its head, right? And we all know that 80%. Well, it's impacting faith-based organizations too. Yeah. And I think, I think we have to move beyond it, perhaps our sphere, moving beyond just, I kind of describe it as this simple illustration of when we raise money, well, we're interested in all the cookies that we can grab around our table, right? Yeah. And I think in some ways we're going to have to release some of that. And, another resource, Peter Greer Weekly, they have a book. It's called The Giver and the Gift. Yep. And it's pretty amazing. This idea of letting go, doing what's best for your donors, doing where's their heart, what are they interested in. And so many times Greer talks about how he even helped people connect with other organizations.
Yeah.
Because those organizations did better.
Yeah.
And his organization wasn't about that, and they couldn't do that. And I think that's part of it too, connecting people. And I don't pretend to explain, I know how all of that works, but somehow it comes back around to your organization. I've seen it over and over and over in almost 20 years of fundraising, and it just always seems to have a way of circling back around. And so I think part of this, maybe this releasing and feeling comfortable in our space, certainly not avoiding the fact that we're faith-based or religious, that we should embrace that and we should welcome that. And at the same time, in a sense, letting go of people that are not supportive, or letting go in the sense that, hey, they're more passionate about something else, and we should feel okay about that. We should be fine with that.
Yeah, Peter's a good guy. I've had the fortunate privilege of he's over in Lancaster, which is just across the Susquehanna River from where I'm at here in central Pennsylvania, and I've had the pleasure of sharing board members. So my last employer and his and Hope International had some common board members, and so there was certainly some influence there. Peter's a pretty sharp guy, and I'd certainly recommend any. There's a number of his books that I'd recommend. So. Stephen, perhaps you're going to, perhaps you'll have a book that I can recommend at some point too. I hope that you're, I kind of get a sense that there's enough ideas and opinions in your head that maybe you can put them on paper at some point. If somebody's interested in reaching out to you, continuing the conversation, perhaps, talking about any number of things, the Lake Institute, Grace, anything that we've talked about today, any of the books we've talked about, how would you suggest that they do that?
Probably the best way is through LinkedIn, through my LinkedIn access. That would be probably one of the best ways to do it.
Okay.
And I don't mind if people want to reach out to me, you can use social media like Facebook as well. That's fine. Reach out to me, and I'm okay with that also.
Cool. Well, Stephen, it has certainly been a pleasure. I look forward to being at a lunch table or a coffee table at some point with you in person. But in the meantime, we'll settle for this. And you're always welcome back. Thank you.
Well, Jason, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.